Okay, so here's the outline of my talk today. The first part, I will describe the building blocks, namely chondrite, minerals and petrology, And then I will describe a little bit of the chemistry, mainly focusing on very volatile depleted nature and its current budget, so that our audience here can think about using this information. And then I will give an example with a few slides about the Earth's atmosphere, that this is a leftover material from the erosion, the residual material, and that evidence is primarily coming from isotopes. So I ran into this slide recently from a colleague of mine by Steve Dash, and that's primarily precisely sort of describe my experience here. That is a two paths to enlightenment. Here's a student, that's me, who come to the temple of astronomers and ask, how do I learn planets and solar system formation? And the answer is, astronomer says, you must find solar systems and planets forming now and observe them thusly. I believe I learned so far the following. As understood by me, that super Earths and mini Neptunes are everywhere. Jupiter lights are far less common. I think I heard loud and clear. Disks run out of gas in only a few million years. That's also very clear. And in this time frame, dust grains grow anywhere from millimeter size to Mars size. That is also seems to be a rule. Planets somehow must form eventually, because we see them everywhere, but we can't see how it was made and where they form. That is also a fair statement. Migration requires gas, but if gas is around, runaway growth would make Jupiters instead of super Earths and mini Neptunes. That seems to be also a rule here. So that's what I learned. Then I go to the Eutheridesis and ask what ancient record of planet formation is the answer. Eutheridesis would look at rocks, and that's the record. So in a way, he says actually making a lot of sense, because this is our inventory. That is, hydrogen and helium makes 99% of elements. And then the astronomers see lithium to uranium is only account for 1.5%. Okay. Then among all those metals, CNOs plus neon dominate more than half of the Z, which is more than half of 1.4%. And carbon and oxygen are the most abundant metals. And here, at least in our solar system, carbon budget is something like 0.25, and oxygen is 0.66. Okay. Since CO is the second most abundant gas next to hydrogen, so having extra oxygen with CO less than one basically seems to be dominating galactic chemical evolution. Reading intensely of the recent paper of Guidos, that convinced me that is the case. So I did read the paper. And that's good, because if you flip around, CO much higher, and then we will run into very different world. Then where we learn from meteoritic record from our solar system might not be quite relevant. And this basically provide the blueprints that whatever we see must be made in other part of the world as well. So this is what I'm going to do now. So we look at the planetary building blocks, that is chondrite. And before I do that, I thought I gave a very brief concept and just get some definition out of the way. So for me, primary solid would be dust inherited from ISMs. And the secondary dust that we see in the background is a chondrite. That includes condensates, evaporation residues, molten chondrules, et cetera, et cetera. Then this is a result of further processing of the primary solids within the solar nebula. So that's my secondary solids. So So if you look at the background, this is a material that we inherit and that we see. Lots of spherical droplets in there. So it's high temperature molten product. Then there are occasionally also some irregular shaped, relatively large object called calcium aluminum rich inclusions. Okay. If you look at a particular example of a particular meteorite, chondrite, you see something like this. Again, lots of chondrules. Right? Around the chondrules, there are actually metals appears to be recording some sort of spinning, and then the metal is actually spun out and sort of concentrated in the ring. Okay? And then it's sort of packed together by very low temperature matrix material. So here's a very brief summary. So this is anatomy of cosmic sediments. What we have is a very high temperature refractory bits and pieces, calcium aluminum rich inclusions, chondrules, and then this is a pack together in this black stuff, which is low temperature fine grain matrix, dark matrix. And this is in these dark matrices you have pre-solar grains that was not destroyed, and you have organic matters, and you have water and other volatiles. Okay. So the question is, how do we make this packed material in the beginning of the solar system? So you have this dichotomy. On one hand, you have very high temperature material, and then you have very low temperature material, and they are together, somehow locked together. Yes?
Maybe this is a good time to slow the train down.
Okay.
before it goes even faster.
Okay.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
First, I can't really tell the difference between, at least from eyesight,
yeah,
one or two of the chondrules and one or two of the CAIs.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question is it a visual distinction, or is it more of a...
Compositionally.
So it's compositional.
Yeah. So calcium aluminum rich inclusions were basically very refractory elements, primarily made of oxide. And chondrules are made of pyroxene and olivine, et cetera, and other glasses. So they are sort of somewhat lower temperature fraction, as in Barbara had.
Just a simple question. Maybe I missed, you said it. What is the sample?
This particular sample is Ayanda, actually.
Yeah. So the CAIs are already crystalline?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Monomineral?
Sorry?
Yeah, monomineral?
There are many, many variety of minerals. So primarily very, very high temperature material, very refractory material.
So it's
things like spinels.
It's not only hibonite, it's more.
He says not only hibonite.
Yeah, there's hibonite.
Ayanite,
yeah. There's a lot of other minerals, yes. Yeah. But if you actually start with a solar composition, everything vapor, and you do the thermodynamic calculation and let the phases condense out, the first material that condenses out of that solar gas is a CAI. And this was calculated in the 70s and observed exactly. Yes?
So if the CAIs are calcium aluminum inclusions, mm-hmm, what is the chemical composition of the chondrules?
Primarily magnesium silicate.
Okay. So
they are somewhere condensed at 1400 K-ish.
Are the calcium aluminum inclusions condensed at a different temperature?
1700 to 1800.
Okay.
Yeah. I wasn't going to go through these details. I thought I'd pass around this the condensation calculation, the graph to the entire group. So I thought I do not want to repeat that, but in the interest of time. But I can re-emphasize that again. Or if you want to really...
So you have
like n-statite in chondrules, right? Yes, there are n-statite in chondrules.
Before you find this, how do you people then explain if low temperature stuff and high temperature stuff in the same place?
Yeah, that's the observation. So that means if you can find answer, that would be huge advancement, right?
How do you know when you say people have some ideas? What are the ideas?
The ideas are basically you have a nebula, relatively cold. And then you have some sort of shock wave going on, or the sources of shock wave various ways of generating shock waves. Among one of them is having Jupiter form first, and then when they go around, and then you generate the spiral arms, and then in those shock waves, you basically heat certain portions of the solar nebula to higher temperature, and then your surrounding is lower temperature. So the higher temperature will generate silicate droplets, and the surrounding cold nebula material would be your background material. So in a sense, that's already sort of set the stage to relatively late stage of the solar nebula.
Well, but if you do the collisional shocks that we discussed or copy earlier, then it can be much earlier.
Right, collision is one other hypothesis that has been advanced, and you will see later that might be a problematic. So did you see this, Lauren? So this is actually a slide that people have calculated long ago. Basically, what it does, the x-axis is a temperature. Oh, I'm sorry. X-axis is a temperature. So anything above 1800 will be everything is wave perform, right? So and then you cool the system down, and then the first things condensed are things like perovskite, hibonite, spinel, and galenite, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the CAIs, okay? So this is the first solid condensate time zero piece, okay? Nothing older than these guys in our solar system. And later on, these are what made the chondrules. Then if you keep dropping the temperature below 900, you'll have other minerals coming out of the system. So,
how consistent are the Nixon ratios between the high, medium, and low temperature?
It varies widely in meteorite record. So for example, this exactly solar-like composition like CI, it has no chondrules, no CAIs, invisible, but entirely made of matrices. And there are other meteorites which is primarily made of chondrules, very little matrices left, so it varies widely.
And do the ones that are made primarily of chondrules tend to lack the elemental compositions of the things that are in matrix?
Exactly. Yeah. So I'll come to that. Yeah. So that's the point of.
Right. Allende that you showed us was relatively rich in matrix, right?
Yeah, sort of intermediate, I would say.
Intermediate?
Yeah. The CI chondrite would be 100% matrices.
I mean, everything you see there is a chondrule, then there are some CAIs. But the CIs, is the matrix, doesn't the matrix include things that could condense at high elements? That would condense at high temperatures from equilibrium?
So there will be some leftover depending on when you actually, it's a very difficult question, which I will address also, is that the matrices has been altered. So maybe anywhere between 4 pieces out of 10,000 meteorite pieces, you will have pristine matrices. All the other stuff have been already altered in the parent body. But if you find those pristine material, they are really like interplanetary dust particles or cometary material or.
But is the matrix in something like this similar to the matrix in the other, or is the matrix here? I thought the matrix in these other types of chondrites tended to be depleted in the very high temperature condensates.
Yes, that's correct. No.
But the matrix in CIs isn't.
It's not, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You
will see that again. So this is two rocks that you are seeing. The quality doesn't matter, except from 1985 era. But what you see, and maybe more modern version is like that. That's X-ray metal elemental distribution. But what you see is something like the granularity is very, very different. Basically, chondrite to very different petrography, very variable proportional chondrites and matrices. Yet they have identical bulk chemical composition. So this is actually termed in our field called Fredrickson's paradox, who first observed this, who is a curator at Smithsonian. So what that actually implies is just from this very simple observation, John made the following implication. That is, it requires a very prompt aggregation with the matrix of the chondro and CAI form. It needs to be far less than orbital period. If chondro continue to orbit for thousands of years after it formed, okay, and you do expect aerodynamically shorted, thoroughly mixed morphology and textural identity should be lost. So it requires, shouting at us, this just simple observation, shouting at us a very local production and reflect a local precursor reservoir chemistry. So that's the...
Is that the reason why you shut down the Nature Science paper that we discussed 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, exactly. So here...
But I don't understand the logic.
Okay. Well, let him explain this diagram, right?
So here is one particular chondrite called Mokoia, and I have many graph like that. And the slope here, iron, in this case, just two elements, plotting iron against chromium. And then slope, that dotted line, is chondritic iron-chromium ratio. Okay? And the chondrite, whole rock itself, is chondritic, right? So then what you have is, so this is a bulk chondrite. Then here is your matrix material, and here is your chondro material. So chondros and matrices, in broad sense, are complement to each other chemistry. So that really is arguing for something like a local production. So you draw the chondros out of boxes, and then the leftover is your matrices, right? So that is requirement. Whatever models that you want to develop about the chondro formation at time zero, it has to explain this kind of chemistry.
Right. And do CAIs also, are they complementary in any way to the rest of the meteorite?
CAIs is actually the proportion of CAI in meteorite is variable and primarily heavily biased in a particular group called CV chondrite. And all other chondrite group has relatively less CAIs. So, you know, these are not elements that you would typically find in CAIs. Okay. So, to some extent, it would still be yes, but it's not all that clear.
For the elements you would typically find in CAIs, mm-hmm. is there also this type of complementarity?
Are you saying that if I look at the CAIs in one place against the...
Well, you're saying that CAIs are most common in CVs.
Yeah.
Do CVs have more calcium and aluminum, or are their chondrules and matrix deficient in calcium?
So, yeah, CV certainly has more calcium and aluminum. Yeah.
The short answer is no. They're not complementary compared to the chondrules. Right. They're distinct. But the other thing is that you have to keep in mind CAIs represent on average sort of 1%. In the meteorite class is less than 1% by volume in the meteorite. So I'm not sure the studies have been done carefully enough to actually address.
But there's no evidence of CAIs forming locally, whereas there is evidence of chondrules forming.
That's right. Yeah. So that's permissible. Yeah.
So you said in your previous slide that this requires them to agglomerate their matrix on less than an orbital period. Why does it have to be so short as that? Why couldn't it just be the local region?
Well, then you say you form chondrules and then you spin around and then this is a finer dust that's much slower. So then you will have some sort of separation already, right? Because you are experiencing some sort of headwind and they may have separated. So
those are fast time scales, but they're not necessarily orbital time scales.
Oh, so. Yeah. That's I'm just directly quoting John Wood from that point. I don't know exactly how to what extent you want to stick to that statement.
Well, also, couldn't you sweep up the matrix on the chondrule so it rides around and then, I mean...
Say it again?
I form a chondrule. There's some stuff around. It gets swept up.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, when the chondrule sticks to something else, it gets reshuffled and makes the matrix. So the chondrule carries with it the matrix material that it was orbiting in. So
But you cannot add more matrix. That's what he said.
Sweep up the right amount.
Yeah, you have to sweep up for exactly the right amount that the whole rock at that scale ended up here. So this added this, you have to make this.
If you form them, say, at an impact, that seems pretty easy. You heat the stuff, there's a vapor cloud around you, and as you pass around the way out, you could restore that balance.
I don't see how can you easily do that. So you have to heat the chondritic target surface, right? And then you generate plumes, and the molten stuff would fly out, maybe at higher speed, and then the unmolten, lower temperature stuff needs to stay around somewhere. And again, the matrices, remember, the matrices are very low temperature stuff. You need to somehow have to preserve all the organics, preserve pre-solar grains. That is not easy to do.
Can you go back to the slide to remind us of your conclusion from this?
From here?
Just read those conclusions again.
So, Crump aggregation, I don't say it has to be less than orbital period. I guess there's some issue I don't understand enough of the dynamics. And so if you actually just spin around for a long period of time, you do expect a dynamically sorted size sorted. So that's together with the chemistry would require local production is a important constraint that one needs to consider.
So if it was just two pieces of matrix colliding, mm-hmm. generating the high temperature, just in part of the sample, right, not mm-hmm. isotropic the whole thing, mm-hmm. you could actually rain out the chondrules, but you're worried that you'd lose the organic compounds.
So your background needs to have some sort of low temperature stuff that make up your matrices. It cannot be total vaporization. So in a sense, this condensation calculation is correct, but it's only in local sense, because we do see isotopic anomalies are everywhere. Obviously, we're not starting from very, very hot, everything vaporized state anymore.
Question? Yeah. The other side before.
Okay.
It says that we think the chondrites formed promptly after after the formation of chondrules and CAIs. Do we think that the chondrules and CAIs formed roughly at the same time, or did the CAIs form much earlier?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I hope Bill might be addressing this. Actually, there's a big issue.
I will.
Big issue is that the CAIs is a time zero, I said. Overwhelming majority of chondrules are about 2 or 3 million years younger. Okay, so in that sense, that's why I allow the chondrules maybe somewhere else and fly in. Right?
CAIs.
For CAIs, right? So the problem is this. So if you have some sort of centimeter or millimeter size CAIs formed, you cannot store them in the nebula disk for 2 million years until you make chondrules and then pack them together. That's a problem. So that is an issue. My effort has been to try to remove that age discrepancy if I can, but haven't. There are some evidence suggests certain fractions of chondrules are zero age as well, but I cannot discount the other population or majority of the chondrules being much younger. That is also true, unless our understanding of the aluminum 26 distribution is not homogeneous. In that case, then it's a different story. We don't know one way or the other. Yeah.
So let me ask about this local production. I think it seems very important. Maybe I want to propose something else, and you tell me why I'm wrong. Let's assume there's somewhere far away from the forming sun a way to make lots of CAIs. There's another place far away from the forming sun that makes all those chondrules. There's some explosion, something called vapor here. And there's a third place that makes all the matrix. And then as the solar system forms, it equilibrates. Uh-huh. It forms this chondritic composition. Now, these three reservoirs will mix them so well that as we mix things together and these things finally coalesce, it looks homogeneous to us. But they came actually from different places, but we mix them. What's wrong with it?
What's wrong is that the matrices, if matrices are composition is like, then you have to find a very matrix composition is like that.
You have to
I think this figure maybe misleading, because I think your claim is not that there's a blob to the left and a blob to the right, but if you had an individual meteorite, you're claiming that the chondrule in that meteorite and the matrix nearby it are complementary.
Yes.
And so really, it's not just there's blob, but each point here is paired with some other point?
No.
No?
No.
So then...
So it's a blob qualitatively on this thing, balance that.
But that's not even true, right? I mean, the blob on the left is wide and narrow, the blob on the right is round. So, I mean, if this is your claim, it's complementary, then it doesn't...
No, you need to consider the concentration of its fractions in this particular meteorite. Right?
How many measurements are each of these points based on? When you're putting these gray points together, how many chondrules and how many chondrule measurements and how many matrix measurements are you averaging?
The point itself is just just one point of measurement on that particular section of that slide.
So one matrix and one chondrule measurement?
Yeah.
Well, then, so
can I jump in to address the question that was asked? I mean, two issues with this. I'm not saying that you can't cook something up, but there are two issues. One is you have to include the sun, because the chondritic composition for refractory elements is basically indistinguishable from the sun. So you cannot do this in isolation from the sun. The second thing is we know there are distinct chondrule families based on oxygen isotopes. So this has to happen more than once. You can't do this somewhere in the nebula once. You have to do it repeated times, and then you have to mix them back together, and they all have to agree again. So now we're talking about something that seems rather procrustean in terms of trying to say. But that's.
Are you saying that if you look at the oxygen isotope ratio within a chondrite, then that ratio is correlated relative to the mean between the matrix and the chondrules?
No, I'm saying there are distinct chondrite families which have different oxygen isotopes.
The question is that if you look separately at the different families, do you separately find this correlation in different locations so that you can actually see that for one family you're mixing the chondrules in the matrix to get the mean, and for another family you're doing the same thing, but it's not that the whole population is being mixed with the whole other population?
So
if you have a meteorite in which is O16 rich, does that mean both the chondrules and the matrix are going to be O16 rich?
Yes, they're coming from the same oxygen isotopic reservoir.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm really confused. Okay. What is Macoya? How many meteorites are on this plot?
Macoya is the name of meteorite.
Single.
There's a single one meteorite.
Okay.
And measure this matrix at different spots on that slide of meteorite that you bought.
So I look at this figure and come to the exact opposite conclusion. I say chondrules vary by a factor of 4 in their iron abundance in the same meteorite. So clearly they must have come from different places in the disk, and that it just can't be local. Why am I totally wrong?
I am not sure.
So you're claiming there's this complementarity, this proves that they form locally.
Yeah.
But I see the chondrules vary in iron by a factor of 4.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me the chondrules in this one meter are very different. Came from a whole bunch of different places. It can't
from
be.
Mineralogy. The iron-containing minerals. No chondrule looks exactly like another one.
So does that mean they can't have all formed locally at the same time? Because otherwise they would have the same composition.
If you add them together, you land up the chondritic line. That's the.
But why would I want to add them together? That makes no sense.
Well, you want to know the composition of the meteorite.
You have to make meteorite.
You're adding a little area in the meteorite with a few chondrules and a little matrix relative to another. So it's hyperlocal, because in this 2-centimeter sphere in the meteorite, if I tell you what the mean composition of the matrix is, you can tell me the mean composition of the chondrules better than just a random within that meteorite.
Well, when you do just a random of particular points, the chances of your error will be very high, right? Given all these scatters. So this is a geochemist looking at sort of broad population and
really
just looking at the broad complementarity.
Are we going to talk about volatile depletions at some point?
Yeah.
Well, just encouraging.
Okay, let's move on.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Okay. So these are details that you will see a variety of type of materials that when you actually look at the rocks. Okay. I think I'll skip this. And here is perhaps more relevant here. So here's a chondro recovered in Sutter's Mill. It's called barred olivine chondrules. Okay, so you have those olivine and bars there. And then in between, there should be glass. But they are totally, totally aqueously altered right now, right? So those are no longer olivine, but they are replaced by magnesium-rich phyllosilicate, iron-rich phyllosilicate. So there's hydrology went on the parent body that totally just destroyed all primary mineralogy, okay? So that's the stories time, that stories that I'm talking about. And here is another chondrules. And then I'm looking at that rim, around that rim, which is here, and you see dolomite. So what does that mean? The dolomite is a secondary mineral again. So you have to form some sort of aqueous fluid that is dissolving, replacing this kind of material, and then form this dolomite. And obviously, because of this production at this particular location, that means this dolomite cannot be formed when chondro are free-floating in the space, but rather it has to be when they pack together in an icy body, water-rich body, then the fluid penetrating.
Andre, we said this is not obvious at all to this drawing, so okay. I think you need to explain more step-by-step. Is there a sequence? Are these four different random snapshots? Like, what's going on here?
The two lower ones are large sections of the two upper ones. You see the squares?
Right. Yeah. So here's a square.
Okay.
I'm looking at this.
But how are the two on the left and the right related?
So these are two separate examples.
So they look nothing alike to me.
Sorry?
They look nothing alike to me.
Right. Yeah, they are two separate examples, so they do not like each other. But that's exactly
the
point.
Two CM congruents. Are they both
emergency? Both are Sutter's Mill, the CM chondrite, but the two chondrules, all right? The two separate chondrules that I'm looking at, that I'm observing. What you have is barred olivine, which has been replaced by this phyllosilicate, that is a water-rich, spongy minerals that carries all the water that you might need. And here is you have a carbonate, a magnesium carbonate that formed on the parent body, yeah.
How can we tell if this aqueous action happened in space as opposed to on Earth, right? This Sutter's Mill is presumably kind of wet location.
Sutter's Mill,
actually a really excellent question. This has been a problem with the study of
this.
This
is an observed fall. So that is that you pick up the second day, which makes the particular meteorite very, very valuable in that sense.
Then the fireball went over the Earth and was observed, and then people went and picked it up really fast.
Okay.
So
doesn't have time to wait.
Then also those terrestrial water, if there was on previous part, if some older material that you find, the you heat them up, the water comes off at different temperature. And you can tell based on the oxygen isotope, for example, whether you're measuring terrestrial oxygen, terrestrial water versus the indigenous water from the parent body. And in fact, by measuring pristine olivine for oxygen isotope composition, and by measuring highly aqueously altered olivine, by measuring oxygen isotope composition, you do the mass balance, you can actually calculate the amount of water that you need to alter to make these products. And this water-rock ratio that comes out anywhere between 0.1 to 0.6. water-rock ratio. So that's a substantial amount of water that you need.
So why do I think there was a lot of water in the bottom left?
Phyllosilicate is a water-rich mineral.
So you actually measure the water molecule today?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
No?
Huh? Oxygen isotopes, from OH.
So you're looking at the 0.16-0.18 ratio shows there was once water, but there's not today.
Yeah, that's right.
But
yeah.
The hydrogen.
That's what we're doing. We're doing
the hydrogen and the oxygen atoms are there. They're just no longer found as water.
That's right. Yeah.
So are these structurally phyllosilicates, or the composition is consistent with something that once was a phyllosilicate?
It is a phyllosilicate now.
But based on diffraction or something?
Yeah.
So based on electron diffraction?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So the water is still there?
Still there, yes.
Because if you lose the water out of a phyllosilicate, it's no longer a phyllosilicate.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a CM chondrite, so.
Okay. So, yeah, so you lose the water out of a phyllosilicate, it's no longer a phyllosilicate. So by labeling and finding the electron diffraction of that clay mineral,
mm-hmm.
we know that that water is still there.
No, careful here, because water exchanges.
But we know that water is still there. We don't know if it's the same water, but water is still there,
yes.
Right?
The leftover, the product.
A couple of statements saying that this thing no longer has water in it. Mm-hmm. I just want to clarify that.
Yeah.
Can you, what does FGR stand for? FGR.
Oh, fine-grained rings.
Got it.
That is surrounding. The assumption is that this thing fell out of the sky, and all the things we see, they were there before it fell.
It was observed to fall out of the sky, more or less.
It couldn't have happened while it was
going through the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, those kind of things you can tell by measuring oxytocin, that the atmosphere particular composition and the material have very widely different composition. And chondritic water has also very different composition. Okay. So the pathway, often discussed is like this. So in this particular paper by Sakamoto et al. In 2007, I've shown you the metals, and if there's hydrogen sulfide, you can make the secondary iron sulfide. If you have iron, you make a magnetite, which is also observed. And so there are several pathways to making these secondary minerals interacting with water. And as of like 2 weeks ago in Nature Geosciences, people find a mineral called the chromium nitrate called Carlsbergite, which is named after beer, I guess, from Denmark.
Carlsbergite.
It's a chromium nitrite. Anyway, they want to decompose ammonium and then make this a very active. nitrogen and interact with indigenous chromium to make the Carlsbergite, right? And so this is several pathways. And this is a typical volatile-rich minerals that you can find in meteorite. And this is a storage for your volatiles, okay? And in so these are the secondary.
So I see a lot of clipping here. I don't see any other.
No.
What volatiles are being stored? So
here.
But everything in the bottom half has nothing but.
It's a sulfide.
A sulfur.
Yeah. Sulfur is a volatile element, right?
But so there's no way to store nitrogen and hydrogen.
Hydrogen.
This
is hydrogen.
But only the top few ones?
Huh?
But only the top few ones.
Yeah, so certainly you don't have hydrogen here. Yeah, of course, the hydrogen.
And so is this exhaustive list meant to tell me that
no, it's not
only
exhaustive.
A small fraction of stuff can store hydrogen, or that the most common things store hydrogen, and you found lots of other obscure stuff that doesn't?
Let me just tell you through this.
Yes, the list has more than 2,000, okay?
Yeah.
He just showed you 12, not to scare you too much.
Yeah. So here is actually a different type of water that you can release when you do when you heat up a rock powder to a different degree of temperature and do the analysis called thermal gravimetric analysis. The first portion of water you lose anywhere between 0 to 200 degree likely is absorbed water, and then you have hydroxide anywhere between 200 to 400. And this is a phyllosilicate, dose bound water that you lose. And then here's a high temperature loss. Okay, so that's gave you amount of water that these guys can carry. So all the way up to any 16% and some as low as a few percent. So this is the water, and it is those rocks that I described will carry those.
Is this weight in just oxygen atoms that Mike could find a hydrogen, or is this a weight in water molecules?
Water molecule will be Chromified water molecule will be this, and then it's just OH. Okay.
Wait, but does all the hydrogen come off as water molecules?
I don't know the answer.
I think the answer is you heat this stuff up and water comes off.
Okay.
But is that because you're heating up in an environment that has a lot of hydrogen? Or if I heat this up just among itself, it's still a big water?
So whatever you have, you have an OH bond in there. The only way it can come off by basically grabbing another hydrogen from some other OH group, leaving one oxygen behind, and then coming off as well.
But if some hydrogen comes off independently, then it's possible that more water came in as part of the formation that still is there, but just changed chemically.
Well, if you have only hydrogen, it means that you had a hydride. Are there hydrides stable in these conditions?
So there's a tiny amount of hydrogen that might be present in the organic phases.
That's also true. That's right.
Very low. Yeah.
Okay.
next. The inventory, these are the same.
In the metals, you don't absorb hydrogen, right?
No. It's not there anymore. These are all, so it's too low pressure. Remember, the chondrules formed at 10 to the minus 5 bars.
And so is the inclusion from this, the degree of alteration is really just a nuisance parameter and all these things basically the same amount of water in them? Nothing matters, they're all...
Well, this is in particular, we're looking at a particular group called CM chondrite, and that CM chondrite group.
So these CM chondrites, they're all the same.
Very different, Then here's another graph basically showing you the amount of carbon carried by this rock. So this is like 10% of carbon all the way, and this is 1%. So you can see the very wide range of carbon content.
But within the CM class, is it still basically within a factor of 2 of 2%?
No, between a factor of 100.
It's a two orders of magnitude, right?
So where are the small crosses and circles?
Those are CVs, less water.
But when you're commenting on the CM is the same amount of water, we're saying just CM class.
So
if I restricted just CM class, it looks to me like they're relatively concentrated. It's once you throw in all
that's
the
right.
other classes.
That's correct. Yeah,
and
certainly true.
Is all this carbon condensed pre-solar?
We're not distinguishing that in this particular graph, I don't think. Because if you are arguing pre-solar, then you are looking at those particular graphite, silicon carbide, etc. Then you measure isotopic composition of those. Those are typically at the ppm range.
Okay.
So the mineral itself is ppm range. So it is a processed material.
Well,
but it could have mainly organics.
But carbon likes to be, if it's heated up, it gets in CO and it stays in CO.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean, or not. These are...
If you heat it up, you will certainly convert the carbon into something else.
But if it was heated upon entry in the solar nebula, can it have gotten into these? Heated to and made into CO.
Yeah.
Can CO from the ISM or from the post-shock solar nebula enter into this meteorite?
In the form of CO?
No,
I think it's a carbon. Basically, from the molecular cloud, you have a lot of variety of the organic stuff that comes in. To the solar nebula, and certainly some of those certainly survive.
Okay, so this was never
sugars and ammonia acid, etc.
Okay, but it's pre-solar in the sense that it wasn't heated to very high temperatures in the solar nebula.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I am terribly running out of time. So I already emphasized that the matrix material is likely cometary. I think that's more or less is clear. So I'm coming to second part of my talk. Should I?
You had no afternoon plans, right?
We have till 2 o'clock because.
Right. Okay. So how long is your talk, Bill?
No, let's just say you have till 2 o'clock.
Well, no, because Bill.
Yeah, Bill has to talk.
Sorry, 1 o'clock.
Yeah, so he has 5 minutes.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
All right. So let's see.
Yeah, you tend to small difference.
So let me give you this slide. All right. So this is a CI chondrite compared to the sun, or actually the photosphere compared to the meteorite. So you have, for overwhelming majority of material, is one-to-one correlation, right? And what you see is CMOs are above, okay? And then hydrogen is here. And what you see in this case is that what it means is that the rock itself, our building block, is depleted in these guys by 9 orders of magnitude for helium. And for that matter, if we build planets with chondritic material, in terms of budget, these guys would not play a major role. Unless you do the accretion kind of scenario. If you degas, helium would not play a major role. You will not have the sort of solar type of composition that I think you are asking. All right. But on the other hand, precisely because you have very little leftover, it actually carries information about how the planet might have formed. And this is a residual gas that we see. Okay, so this is a quick, and then let me jump through the last part of the talk then. So Earth's atmosphere. So it's often, we use the classic deuterium to hydrogen ratio to look at the material that delivered volatiles to Earth. And the argument is because all the cometary objects are sort of far away from the Earth, chances are overwhelming majority of the volatiles has to be delivered by this chondritic material. But so this is one graph from this Rosetta Mission's science paper that just came out. And if you look at the graph of similar nature by Alexander, it looks like this. So the same cometary material, but actually chondrite is way below the Earth's line. Why is that? It's because Colonel Alexander is actually looking at that water, the chondritic water, before interaction. So here, the data.
Before what?
Before interaction and alter the rock.
What's the alternative?
You have water, and you cook with a rock, and then that leftover collectively is what was measured here. Okay? So you measure water composition, the D2H ratio in meteorites today. This is a composition that you. What he has done in this case is you have measurement from those phyllosilicate, and you have a pristine measurement, pristine oxygen acid composition, and you do the mass balance to try to infer the water composition that made these guys come.
Does this mean that the deuterium goes preferentially into the rocks? You need the rocks to be present to sort of take in some deuterium for this to change?
So the way he did, I think, is the Colonel did is looking at the balance between organic D2H ratio versus the rock itself, and then extrapolate that linear correlation to zero carbon, that will be the water. Okay, so that's a pure water that is before interacting with a rock, with a parent body, is like this.
It sounds utterly ludicrous. Why is that a good thing to do?
He's trying to learn what is a water composition look like.
But why would you think that you could measure a D to H ratio of water in rock, a D to H ratio of water in something that's some carbon in it, and extrapolate to zero to get what the water was?
That is a major carrier. In chondrite, major carrier for the hydrogen and deuterium will be either in carbonate, or in phyllosilicate, or in.
Has this method been validated on anything where we actually know?
It was published work, right?
No, but they tested it.
I think that the answer is most likely there's no
I know that guy. He's very, very careful. He uses very, very well. You've got different things, but overall, that is probably as well as you know at this point. I would just close at this point. Okay. I will slowly switch over. But you can trust the guys doing this very careful work. They do the maximum out of these measurements possibly do. Please trust them.
So let me just rephrase what I think has just been said here, and that is there are two major carriers or phases for the deuterium. This is the most important one. One of them is the organics, which is extremely deuterium-rich and has a huge scatter.
That's right.
And so what Connell did was basically try to separate those two and only look, sort of mathematically, and only look at the composition of the water.
Yeah.
By basically trying to subtract the contribution from the other
That's
phases.
Right. Yeah. But and given that case, basically it carries important message. I bring this for a good reason. That is, if we want to argue, that the meteorite, meteorite like this delivered Earth-like water, right? That means we're delivering that end product that is already mixed, that the water cooked together with rock, and that thing is delivered to Earth, and then you release the water, and that makes Earth water, right? And that's the argument, is it? But here is a flaw with the cometary argument. That comet, when we look at the comet, we're looking at the hydrogen molecules coming off from the comet. Until we go there and measure the rocks, I don't think it is that argument. That, because we are, if you're looking at the water itself in meteorite, it is down here. So based on the same argument, you could even have ruled out the meteorite also delivered water that to Earth as well, right?
So you mean the values for the comets would come down to the blue line?
So if you have some other phases, that if you look at the Bach rocks, it could go come down to very low value, right?
So if you stretch it to the maximum, we only have the 2 o'clock, and we need a 5-minute break. Thank you so much.
Sure.